Let's go ahead and open our Bibles today to 1 Kings chapter number 9, and we're going to pick up our story in verse 23. And what's happening is the author of 1 Kings, and also Chronicles, by the way, probably prophets, they are letting us know about all the different construction projects that King Solomon was involved in after he'd finished the temple of God. So after he'd finished with the palace of God, he turns around and works on his own palace complex and makes it glorious. And then he just engages in all sorts of other construction projects. And he's got a ton of people working on all of these things. Mostly, the heavy labor is being done by non-Israelis that have lived in the land. They're Canaanites. Their ancestors were never driven out by previous generations. And so they've kind of just been turned into a perpetual, hardworking lower class. That's kind of what's happened. And Solomon is putting all the Israelis in charge of other things, such as serving in his military, which is mostly just for show, because he's at peace with everybody around him, and in all the administration of the kingdom, because this kingdom is getting bigger and bigger and more glorious as time goes on. And so I think we're looking at a point somewhere just beyond halfway through his 40 years. So we're talking about the 950s BC that all these things that we're seeing are happening. So 1 Kings 9:23, these were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work. 550 who had charge of the people who carried out the work. So he's got Israelis that are in supervisory roles, keeping the Canaanites busy during doing all the work that they've been assigned to do. Verse 24, something we've already talked about. But Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. So part of the residence area of the complex of David's palace has a separate designated building for the princess of Egypt that Solomon seems to have married when he was very young, when he was still a teenager under his father. And this is probably related to the arrangements made for that marriage, that she was not going to be forced to live in close proximity to any other of Solomon's wives, but that she would have this special prominence. Now, she has spent the last 20-plus years living somewhere in the city of David, but not in David's palace, because the Ark of the Covenant was located in that complex, and neither David nor Solomon felt that it would be appropriate for a foreigner, an unbelieving foreigner, to be anywhere near where the Ark of the Covenant was located, God's throne on earth. Now, there is a little bit of disconnect, spiritual disconnect in all of this, because we know that the Israelis were told that they were not supposed to multiply wives to themselves, especially the kings were not supposed to do this, and yet both David and Solomon engaged in that behavior. They still got things done for God, but they were not perfect in their obedience, and that's problematic. And it brings about great trouble later. As we will see, it's the multiplying of his wives that pretty much ruined Solomon and may have even cost him his eternal soul. Okay, verse 25. 3 times a year, Solomon used to offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he built to He Who Is, making offerings with it before He Who Is. And so he finished the house. Now, this seems to be just an acknowledgement that beyond the dedication ceremony that Solomon led when the temple was first inaugurated, every year he came up to the temple complex and led in a special public ceremony for Passover, Pentecost, and Feast of Tabernacles, because those are the three mandatory festivals that all adult Israeli men living inside the boundaries of the Promised Land and being within good health, they had to come to Jerusalem, to the temple, for those observances. And so Solomon apparently makes that a big deal that he leads in that. Not that he offers the sacrifices, but that he orchestrates those ceremonies, just like he did for the dedication. Then we find out, verse 26, that King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Elot, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. So if you go south from the southern end of the Dead Sea, you will come to the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba. And Ezion-Geber is on one side of that north shore, and Elot is on the other side of that north shore. And this becomes a port for Solomon's fleet of ships, and it's a partnership that he engages in with Hiram of Tyre. Now, Hiram, remember, is a Phoenician leader. Phoenicians are world-renowned at this time for major construction projects, building big buildings, so that's why they helped Solomon in the temple and the palace complexes, and of ships. And so Hiram is helping Solomon get a shipping industry started, helping build these ships and sail these ships into great big trade missions that stretch a long ways away from the land of Israel. So Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen, who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. Now, these ships are probably going to be referred to as ships of Tarshish. And that becomes a little bit of a confusion point, because Tarshish seems to be the name of a place in western Spain. And this port on the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba would not be a normal place you would sail out of to go to Tarshish on western Spain. That you would sail out of a place like Joppa if you were wanting to go there. So it's possible, I think maybe even likely, that it is the ship design that is being referenced later when it talks about ships of Tarshish, meaning these are the same design ships that were used by the Phoenicians to do their sailing in the Mediterranean all the way out to Tarshish, which was its farthest trade mission point. All right, so this group sailing out of the Gulf of Aqaba, it says that they went to Ophir and brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon. Now, where is Ophir? No one knows for sure, but suggestions have been made that Ophir might be on the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. And I think that makes good sense. Another suggestion is that it might be somewhere on the south east coast of the continent of Africa. That also can make some pretty good sense, because we know that these trade missions are going to bring back ivory and perhaps apes. And those are both available in that region of Africa. Or It's possible that it might be on the Indian subcontinent and maybe even the island of Sri Lanka that is just off of the subcontinent of India. And now I think the island of Sri Lanka might have another name now, but it's Myanmar maybe, but it's escaping me at the moment. But anyway, all of those places would have been accessible to a ship sailing south through the Gulf of Aqaba, joining the main body of the Red Sea, sailing south some more, and going through the strait that exists between modern-day Yemen and modern-day Djibouti, something of that nature is the name of the country. Eritrea might be there as well. But then from there through the Gulf of Aden and either around the Horn of Africa and along the southeastern coastline of the continent of Africa. So that's one possible place that this sailing convoy could have gone. Or it could have followed the shoreline along the southern end of the Gulf, or excuse me, the Arabian Peninsula, and then up and along the coast that goes to the subcontinent of India. Both those directions would have been clearly accessible to any ship sailing out of this place that we're talking about. Now, in both cases, though, this shipping of Solomon would go right by where the country of Sheba was located. Now, Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, he tried to locate Sheba at a city in Ethiopia, a city that eventually becomes Meroe, M-E-R-O-E. But that doesn't make good sense to me because that city doesn't seem to exist prior to the 6th or 7th century BC. And we're talking about Solomon doing all of this in the 10th century BC. So I think it's much more likely that the country of Sheba is actually the country of Saba, which is located in modern-day Yemen on the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula. And so this country would have controlled the long shoreline that Solomon's ships would have had to go by in order to get out into the Indian Ocean, whether they were going along the coast of Africa or along the coast of Asia. So that would explain how this next story gets started. 1 Kings chapter number 10. Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of he who is, she came to test him with hard questions. So as these ships of Solomon go by, they bring all sorts of stories of this shining kingdom of Israel, how this man who started as a young man on the throne has been displaying great wisdom and intellect and great abilities to build the temple of he who is in great magnificence and to build his own palace structure. And all of that information reaches the ears of the queen of this country about 12 or 1300 air miles away from Jerusalem. And when she hears this, she's like, well, that I can't believe that. That's just amazing. And she decides that she should come and check it out herself firsthand. And in the New Testament, by the way, this woman is referred to as the Queen of the South. And that makes good sense because where we're talking about is south, southeast from Jerusalem. So verse number 2 says, she came to Jerusalem with a great retinue, with camels bearing spices, and very much gold and precious stones. So she brings the things that pass for wealth and glory in her country, which would be all sorts of spices. It appears that the Sabaeans, the kingdom of Sheba, had kind of control of the spice trade that was part of this area of the world, as well as a lot of gold and precious stones that came through this region. And they seem to be a seafaring race, and so that would make them very much the controllers of any trade routes that came past their country. So I don't know whether they got on board ships and sailed up to Ezion Geber and got off and then made the rest of the trip up to Jerusalem on the camels, or whether they simply walked all along the shoreline, along the trade routes, the 1,300 plus miles from Sheba up to Jerusalem. But after she arrives, this is what happens. When she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind, meaning that she started testing his wisdom. She'd constructed puzzles and riddles and thorny matters of justice, and she wanted to see how he would deal with these things. She may have also been asking about natural things, because we know from the book of Proverbs, or excuse me, the historical writings about Solomon's Proverbs, that he also was very much a student of animals and plants and knew all about them. So she is basically just grilling him on all sorts of things. And verse number 3 reports, Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, so he'd passed her tests, her examinations, all the thorny questions that she'd brought, he had no problem with it. So now she realizes he is a very wise and very intellectual man. And so not only did she see that, but she also saw the house that he had built. That would be the temple specifically, but also his palace, the food of his table. So she's eaten probably a state dinner in the grand house of the Forest of Lebanon. That would have been an amazing thing. The seating of his officials, so all his grand court, the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and their clothing as well. So all of his wait staff. We just finished not too long ago with the whole opera of the Song of Songs. And we know that the woman worked in food services and in the guest services, as I was putting it, for this grand palace of Solomon. So all of that is high class stuff. And so she sees all of that. It's as if she was staying in the best hotel in the world and eating in the best restaurant of that hotel. And all of the staff is dressed in grand style and very polite. And the food is something amazing to eat. But she also goes and sees the things that happen in the temple. Says that she saw his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of He Who Is. So she goes to a worship service with him and sees and hears all the sacrifices and the music and the prayers. And once she'd seen all of that, there was no more breath in her, meaning it took her breath away. And she said back to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom, but I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes have seen it. And behold, the half was not told me." So she heard all of these stories of the passing trading vessels. And she's like, nah, it can't be. That can't be true. So she comes and she sees it all firsthand. It takes her breath away. And she has to acknowledge to Solomon, not only were the stories that I heard true, they weren't even half of the truth. I thought they were exaggerations, but they didn't even really capture the reality at all. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I've heard. Happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. So she is thinking, the people who work for you are blessed. This would be an amazing place to live. Blessed be he who is your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because he who has loved Israel forever, he has made you king that you may execute justice and righteousness. So she acknowledges something special about God in this, which really is something of what Solomon had in mind when he did these things, that the temple would bring glory to God and would draw in non-Israelis and perhaps convince them to worship the one and true and living God. And probably he had a similar idea when he built his palace, is that Israel, Jerusalem, would become this shining example of righteousness and justice would convince people to embrace the true and living God. Verse number 10. Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Now, why is she giving all of this? Well, it's possible, based on some oral traditions and things here, she might have lost a bet, that she might have engaged in a wager that I can give you things you can't unravel. I can lay before you questions and difficulties, puzzles that you can't solve. And I'll bet you, you can't. And if I lose, I'll give you all of this. So that's a possibility. But it's also just as possible that this was her way of saying thank you for the experience of coming here and seeing your kingdom and being in your presence and having all of this amazing stuff that I can think about for the rest of my life. Verse number 11. We'll go back to the fleet now. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. Now, this almug wood, it seems to either be from the Indian subcontinent or from southeastern Africa. And what have I been saying? That's probably the two possible places Solomon's trade convoys, his shipping, has been going. And then also precious stones. The king made of the almug wood supports for the house of he who is, for the king's house, and also lyres and harps for the singers. And no such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. So it's a very special wood, and it gets used for special things, musical instruments and decorative woodwork in the temple and the palace. King Solomon gave to the queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked besides what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. And so she turned and went back to her own land with her own servants. So she apparently requested a few things from him. We don't know what those requests were, but he agreed that you can take these key things with him. Maybe she asked for some priests to join her back into her country to take the message of the one true and living God back to the country of Sheba. But we then go to verse 14, which describes the wealth that's coming in. No, I don't want to do that just yet. We're almost out of time today. So what we're going to do is when we come back next week, we've got this passage that's coming up plus another passage from 1 Kings chapter 4 that describes the immense wealth of the kingdom of Solomon and how this wealth is distributed across the entire community. Not just simply the upper tier are wealthy, but everybody is being blessed by all the good things that are happening under King Solomon. Have a blessed weekend, and Lord willing, we'll get together again on Monday.